Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Florida is bracing for a direct hit from Hurricane Irma. The storm has weakened to Category 4, but the National Hurricane Center still describes it as an extremely dangerous storm. Here's Governor Rick Scott speaking this morning.
We are running out of time. The storm is almost here. If you are in an evacuation zone, you need to go now. This is a catastrophic storm that our state has never seen.
Joining us now is NPR's Greg Allen. He's in Miami. And Greg, are people there heeding Governor Scott's warning to evacuate? Is Miami deserted?
Well, you know, people certainly are heeding his evacuation order in a big way. I think there's some sense that people could be complacent, but not this time. People are taking very seriously. That's not to say everyone's evacuating. My neighborhood's an evacuation zone. I was just walking around. I could see that some people are staying for the long haul. But it's a decision each person has to make. But the governor and many other public officials have been doing their best to convince everyone who's in an evacuation zone to get out as soon as they can, because time's running out.
Well, and people who have left Miami and other parts of South Florida have headed north. That's the only way you can go to get to safety. But we're hearing about gas shortages and terrible traffic on the highways.
Well, and, you know, the thing is, they keep one. It's kind of a misperception that you have to go north. Is what they want to do is get people away from the coasts. And that message sometimes gets lost. And so everyone jumps on the interstates and starts going north on I-95 and the Florida Turnpike and Interstate 75. And like you say, it's been just crazy up there. It's taken, you know, five times as long to get any distance. It's back wall-to-wall traffic. And there's a shortage of fuel. So some officials have started saying, you don't have to go there. Just stay with family and friends in from the coast. You just have to get out of the evacuation zones, because those are the areas that they're worried that storm surge could inundate them. And it's, as you know, Jeremy, I'm sure it's flooding, not wind, that's the really big killer in hurricanes.
Right. And what about people who decided to evacuate by air? What's going on with the flights that have been leaving Miami?
Well, today's the last day for flights from Miami and from Fort Lauderdale's airport. I think I forget exactly what time, but later today they're shutting down. And, you know, if you don't have a seat on one of those flights, I don't think they're available. Prices, as you know, went way up.
Right.
And then came, the airlines took a hit on that, and many kind of froze their prices and even cut them in some cases. But the last flights are today. Traffic, you know, it's really getting too late to drive out of the state at this point. What they worry is that people will get stuck on the road
right
tomorrow when the high winds are picking up, you know.
If people can't or won't evacuate, what arrangements are being made for them?
Well, we're seeing this amazing number of people go to shelters. In Miami, I think there's 8 open. More will be opened later today. Already we've got shelters that are full, that have big lines waiting to get in. I know some shelters are full in Broward County. In Miami, they want to have shelter space for as many as 100,000 people. You know, that's a lot of people. And so and what the mayor of Miami-Dade County has said is that their main problem at this point is getting enough volunteers and workers to staff the shelters. They're using schools mostly, and they're using Red Cross volunteers, but the mayor said, we're out of volunteers. Now they're impressing National Guardsmen to go in and provide help there. And they'll also use some, you know, school principals and volunteers from the schools to come in as well, but that's the big obstacle right now, is enough people to staff these shelters.
Whatever damage might come from this storm, one thing that's pretty certain is that there will be power outages. There was a briefing from Florida Power and Light today. What did they say?
Well, you know, they didn't try to sugarcoat it. I guess we could expect that. What the CEO of Florida Power and Light said is that they expect to lose that as many as 9 million of their customers could be affected. That's 90% of their customers in Florida. And they're the largest utility down here. They serve all of South Florida. So almost all of their customers are going to lose power during the storm, is what they said. Now, the issue there is they can only operate their plants, their fossil fuel plants, natural gas plants here mostly, up to 100 mile per hour winds. And we're certainly expecting to see winds that high throughout very large portions of the state. So many of those natural gas plants are going to be shut down. That's going to be the first issue. When they restart a plant, then it takes them several hours to go and do inspections of all the transmission lines to make sure it's safe to restart them. So you can anticipate that for the people, the best case scenario for people who really get to get off easiest are going to lose their power probably for a day or more until they can get out and get these power lines checked. But beyond that, they're worried that they're going to have to actually rebuild entire sections of the grid here. It's not just a question of restoring it, it's actually rebuilding it, and that could take weeks or months. We've heard that phrase as well.
And Greg, you live there in Miami. What's the feeling as this storm approaches?
Well, I think trepidation would be a nice way to put it. Anxiety would be another way. It's hard to keep your, you know, to focus on getting prepared, and that's right. The issue. You know, you can drive yourself crazy looking at the spaghetti models, they call them, the computer modeling. You know, is it going to go this way or that way? Because that really affects, you know, that has an impact on every single one of us, where that storm actually makes landfall, where it goes. But if you do that, you know, it distracts you from the main thing, which is just do everything you can to be prepared and right. Let Mother Nature take its course.
That's NPR's Greg Allen in Miami. Greg, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, that deal on Harvey relief money and government spending that President Trump negotiated this week with Democratic leaders is done. The House of Representatives passed it this morning, 316-90. The Senate passed it yesterday. It's on its way to the president for signing. The deal forced some Texas fiscal conservatives to vote for the first time for an increase in the debt limit, and it shocked Republicans. This morning, President Trump tweeted, "Republicans, sorry, but I've been hearing about repeal and replace for 7 years. Didn't happen." Joining us, Susan Davis, NPR congressional correspondent. Hi, Suze.
Hey, Robin.
So what are lawmakers saying to what seems like the president saying to Republicans, "I'm moving on without you"?
It certainly did sound like it. I will say there, as you said, there's still a lot of shock and frustration among Republicans. This morning before the vote, OMB Director, Budget Director Mick Mulvaney and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin met with House Republicans in a closed meeting, and they got an earful. Republicans expressed frustration that the president undercut their speaker and that they couldn't offer any guarantees that when they have to address this debt limit spending deal again in December, remember this was only a short-term punt, they were given no assurances that the administration will seek any kind of debt offsets or spending offsets in the next round of the debt limit increase. So yes, it passed this morning with bipartisan support. It passed the Senate with bipartisan support. But there is a lot of lingering frustration among Republicans over how this went down.
Well, so bad. We're hearing that at that meeting when Steve Mnuchin asked Republicans, "Vote for the debt ceiling for me," they hissed. And to remind ourselves, conservative Republicans want to put this off until after the midterms because they've pledged not to raise the borrowing capability without those offsets you mentioned. But on Fox News, Newt Gingrich defended the president's tweets on the deal. Let's listen.
This is a one-time deal. For the president, it's a very smart deal. Mm-hmm. It gets momentum the first week back. It changes the tone. It gets the money to Houston. And it postpones the big fight over the debt ceiling for 90 days. And I think the president's attitude is, who knows what's going to happen over 90 days?
You know, is he right? With one fell swoop, three things off the table, you know, debt, Harvey spending, and government spending, so that Congress maybe moves on to tax reform, considering DACA. Is Gingrich right?
You know, it's easy to defend it when you don't have to cast a vote. I can tell you that Republicans don't, when they don't know what to expect next, it creates a lot of uncertainty. And the fact that they sort of loaded all of these questions into December, history would tell us that Congress isn't very good at handling multiple competing deadlines. And if the focus they wanted it to be this fall, almost singularly on their tax plans, they want to pass a tax cut, knowing that they're going to have another budget shutdown doesn't make that any easier. There's nothing to point to in the past that says, oh, well, they did it this time. Now, it's not to say they can't do it, but the suggestion that this was a savvy deal that will make tax legislation easier, I think, is spin, and there's really no other way to put it.
Well, Arizona Senator John McCain, North Carolina Congressman Walter Jones say they've never seen anything like what President Trump did in all their years on Capitol Hill. This is striking the deal with the Democrats. Then you also have the announcement that he wants to rescind DACA and pump that to Congress, saying that it's illegal and unconstitutional. But then right afterwards, tweeting out, "If Congress doesn't do something, I'm going to revisit it," sort of implying that maybe he would reinstate it. So why would they bother working to rewrite it and make it a law? What are some of the feelings there in Congress?
I think increasingly Congress and lawmakers on both sides recognize they're dealing with a really unpredictable president. Remember, at that Wednesday meeting where he did cut the deal with Democrats, Republican leaders walked into that meeting with private assurances from White House senior staff that the president was on their side, that he was going to advocate for a longer-term debt ceiling increase. And the president called an audible in the meeting. He made, of his own accord, a decision to agree with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi that that was the best way to go. Now, they say he wants to maybe try a bipartisan tact at dealing with Congress. Remember, we're in September, and the first-term president doesn't really have much in the ways of big legislative wins to go to the electorate and say, look, I'm delivering on my promises. So I think he's frustrated and congressional Republicans are frustrated, but they want to be moving the agenda in a very different direction. Having an immigration fight was not at all what Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had outlined for this fall. And it looks like we might be having an immigration fight, whether they like it or not.
Well, imagine if the year ends with President Trump increasing government spending, lifting the debt ceiling, maybe approving new protections for Dreamers and not getting tax reform. I've got conservative radio host Laura Ingraham saying that Republicans are finished if they don't do that. Sue Davis, NPR congressional correspondent with what sounds like a dizzying or dizzied Congress right now. Sue, thanks so much.
You bet.
And it's Friday when we take a couple minutes to look at the news through social media. So let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin.
And I want to start with Myanmar. Nobel laureates are calling out that country's de facto leader, the Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, for not speaking out against the persecution of the country's Rohingya Muslim minority. Now, South Africa's Desmond Tutu, who's been, you know, withdrawn from public life in recent years.
He retired.
Yeah.
He said, I am not speaking about anything in public life anymore. I'm retired. Not even if you begged me am I going to come out of my private retirement until this week.
Right. And what did he say?
He says, my dear sister, this is a letter to Aung San Suu Kyi he posted on Facebook. If the political price of your ascension to the highest office in Myanmar is your silence, that price is surely too steep. He is commenting on the pictures that we've all seen on the news of Rohingya Muslims fleeing from their villages that are being burnt down. We have reports of women and children being killed. They are trying to get to Bangladesh. These are horrific pictures. It is a humanitarian crisis. His comment came a day after a comment from Malala Yousafzai. She was the youngest person ever to receive the Peace Prize. She's very direct. Over the last several years, I have repeatedly condemned this tragic and shameful treatment of the Rohingya. I am still waiting for my fellow Nobel laureate, Aung San Suu Kyi, to do the same. Very direct. Yeah. 70,000 shares just on that one post, and then reignited an entire conversation about the leader of Myanmar and what she should be doing and saying right now.
And there's also an online petition at change.org, so people can look at that. 386,000 people have signed that. But I want to just quick touch with you about Hurricane Irma, because you remind us it's huge on social media, but primarily with people sharing information. What are they saying?
Advice. Hurricane preparation. This comes from a Florida mom. It was shared by Mike's Rain on Twitter, and he said he copied from a friend who copied from a friend who copied from a friend. How good could this advice be? Florida peeps, advice from a Florida mom who's been through many a hurricane. Capitals, empty your dishwasher and put anything you want to preserve in there. It's waterproof and secured to cabinets, so it's more likely to survive a storm. Tell your friends. I have never heard that, Robin. I've covered so many hurricanes. I've never heard about the dishwasher safe.
And then maybe gaffer tape it shut, you know, just for
exactly.
safety.
Exactly.
Also,
I mean,
there's some
great
tips.
Advice there.
There's some tips for pets. I just want to hear that.
Take your pets. We've seen pictures and images from Harvey just 2 weeks ago where people had left their dogs, they left their pets, they were looking for their cats. So take your pet. Interesting piece of advice here from the St. Augustine Beach Police Department. They posted, take your insurance claims number and then follow your insurers on social media so you can get the latest updates. Hadn't thought about that. Lots of Floridians are posting about the best chargers for your phones, for your iPads, so that you can actually keep all your electronic devices full of juice. And then also lots of apps like @GasBuddy that will tell you where you can get gas from, which gas stations have gas, and how to keep safe.
I love
so
these.
Many places to look. #Irma, you'll have all of the information out there. And actually, for once on social media, good, mostly accurate info to.
Freeze water in your pet bowls if you have to leave them behind so that they have water and it'll melt as it goes. Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. I just love it. Hashtag Irma Tips. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Irma is dredging up memories of 1992's Andrew, the most destructive hurricane ever to hit Florida. It passed through Homestead, Florida City, and Cutler Ridge like an invisible freight train, completely destroying 26,000 homes, 40,000 businesses, damaging 100,000 other homes. Dozens died in total. I was reporting for ABC TV at the time. Listen closely past Andrew's winds to hear the voices of some teenagers and first a mom who felt the storm in her cheeks.
Your ears hurt like you're in an airplane, but your cheeks hurt, your teeth hurt, everything hurt.
Everything started shaking, the walls, the roof. A piece of drywall fell on my head, and I was like, God, I don't know what's going to happen.
I have dreams about it. Like just last night I had a dream about another hurricane, except it was in a different town.
Days after Andrew hit, there would be counseling for kids in what remained of schools.
It's like you expect to see a tree or something when you drive by and it's not there. Or you expect to go to like a store that you want to go and you drive up there and there's not even a shopping center left.
You said that during the fire drill you're supposed to go to the flagpole?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no flagpole.
I think the worst thing that was after the hurricane, not knowing where my friends were and when died.
Yeah, I'm still angry. I'm still angry. I guess just at nature.
2 months after Andrew, we visited Doris Manassas and her family, still living in a small trailer at the curb of the large dream house they'd built by hand. During Andrew, Doris watched as her husband and teenage boys tried to hold the huge front doors against Andrew. When it blew the doors in, it almost killed them.
I don't know if I'll ever get over the guilt. And they've lost so much of their childhood. This was the first time in their lives that I couldn't protect them from something. And I feel that I could have taken them and left. And I think my husband and I both feel so guilty that we didn't. We just didn't know. We just didn't know.
We just didn't know. Sounds from 1992 and Hurricane Andrew. Brian Norcross was also covering the storm for NBC affiliate WTVJ, anchoring a 23-hour broadcast. He's now a hurricane specialist at the Weather Channel. He joins us. And Brian, as you watch Irma, what are your thoughts of Andrew?
Well, I dread what I see with Irma after seeing what happened after Andrew. And we see Irma coming as an entirely different kind of hurricane, but with the potential to do the kind of damage that we saw with Andrew, but over a tremendously wider part of the state. This storm is so much bigger and is going to travel over so much more of Florida that I just dread the pictures we're going to see after this is over.
We'll explain that because we've heard that Irma has been downgraded to a Category 4. We know that's maybe just a small distinction of just a few miles per hour. But when you see this picture that's going around, and we'll post it at hearnow.org, it's someone's laid over the track of Andrew in 1992 with the track of Irma. Andrew looks like a little tiny peanut compared to Irma, and Andrew was a number 5.
Right. Well, so Andrew was small and strong, and Irma is big and mighty. So yeah. The peak winds may not be as high, but most of the damage you saw in Andrew was not done by the peak winds. It was done by the fact that you had an area of winds that were Category 3 to Category 5, and it was like a tornado that went through this 25-mile-wide area.
Right.
Well, this is going to be a 125-mile-wide area with winds that will be above hurricane strength and maybe even as much as 100 miles of Category 3 or Category 4 winds. So this is just a much more encompassing storm.
Well, and things have changed. The waters are warmer, so are you speculating there might be more rainfall to add to the wind damage? And also, the area has changed. Can you talk a little bit about that as well? After Andrew, there were building requirements. Talk more about that.
So Irma is likely to go through a little bit of a weakening phase here as it's restructuring and is near the Cuban coast, which is really the Gulf Stream, which is extraordinarily warm. And that's where Andrew intensified before it slammed into southern Miami-Dade County. So that's why we think that Irma even has an opportunity to, however strong it is when it's near Cuba, to get stronger when it hits Florida. It's really not attributable to the fact that generally the world is warmer. It's just that that's an extremely warm part of the ocean right there, South Florida. As far as the building, it's stunning. If anybody that has not seen Miami over the last decade and the growth in Southeast Florida, it's unbelievable. But the good news is that in the Miami area and the Fort Lauderdale area, the buildings are built to the strongest building code in the world for hurricanes.
Talk more about that. There's glass. I mean, one of the problems is flying debris. Many people are killed or are killed by this debris. There's glass that's much thicker than it would be in other areas to withstand that.
It's not just glass that's thicker. Actually, the glass has a kind of a bulletproof glass sandwich inside of it, the inner part of the stuff we call glass on impact windows. Now, I hasten to add that, you know, this is a big city. It's been a big city for a long time. There are a lot of buildings that are not to the ultimate building code that exists today, that the new buildings are up to. So we would expect widespread damage over South Florida with this hurricane. But the difference is that in Hurricane Andrew, almost every building in the path of the core of the storm was uninhabitable.
Well, and what about the homes? Some beautiful, you know, mansion-like, some very small, but all of them not up to speed. What's changed there in building requirements?
Well, now, before you can build a home, you have to choose the pieces you're going to use. And every single window, every single door, shingle, siding has to be tested, physically tested. They actually shoot a cannon at it with a 2x4 coming end on, and it has to pass that before it's allowed to be in a home.
Look, there's also better forecasting. We heard that woman say, we just didn't know, we just didn't know. From what you know, Brian Norcross, you're looking at Irma. What would you tell people in Florida?
That this is an extreme hurricane threat for the entire state of Florida, except for the far western panhandle. So you have to go back to when Florida was an entirely different place and most of it was not developed and was not populated to see a hurricane like this approaching the state. It's not unprecedented, but it is unprecedented in modern times.
Brian Norcross, who knows from whence he speaks, he covered Andrew, is now keeping an eye on Irma at the Weather Channel. Brian, thanks.
All right, thank you.
The bidding war has begun. Cities around the country are hoping to capture the attention of retail giant Amazon after it announced plans yesterday to start accepting proposals for its second North American headquarters. There are some usual suspects already talking about trying to win the prize, but some smaller contenders as well. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, we only heard about this announcement yesterday, and already it seems like every city is trying to get in there. What is Amazon looking for?
Well, it's been pretty specific, and it's a brilliant move by Amazon because they're going to get all these bidders. They want metropolitan areas that have more than a million people, of which there are 53 in the United States and 6 in Canada, because they want a big pool of people on which to draw for employees. They want it to have what they call a stable and business-friendly environment. That we can talk about later. They want at least, you know, they've got sort of territorial requirements. They need 100 acres, 500,000 square feet to build. They want proximity to an international airport, and they have to be able to get to Seattle, New York, San Francisco, and Washington by flight. Cities have until October 19 to submit.
So what cities are we hearing from so far?
The usual suspects, Chicago, Dallas, San Diego. Toronto has included itself in there, Vancouver, Philly, D.C., the Twin Cities, Pittsburgh, Houston, even New York has, San Antonio, Atlanta. Remember, these are all airline places or airline hubs. Smaller cities are Raleigh, Charlotte, Tampa, Oakland, Baltimore, Nashville, Syracuse, and Rochester.
Well, and I have to say, just because of where I am in Boston, it's been leading the local news here, too.
Yep.
So people,
people
are trying to get. So what about what's going to be required to do this? Is this going to be just about the best tax incentives from any of these cities?
You know, that's always the criticism of these things. When you've seen Google do this in the past, you've seen that cities do all sorts of crazy things. But yes, fundamentally, it's tax incentives are a big deal. But for Amazon, it's going to be a steady worker pool. Now, they use the term business friendly. Remember, there are a lot of cities around the United States who are talking about or in slightly higher wage areas. That's a big push, a big movement. Amazon Amazon's not going to love the idea of going into a place with a $15 minimum wage. That said, they operate in a higher wage in Seattle. So, and they argue that they're very good for business in places like Seattle. So this is always the push and pull when a business dangles a carrot like this out there. How much are cities and states willing to give up to get that business?
Do small cities have a shot here?
Yeah, they do, for an interesting reason. There are, you know, we think of Silicon Valley, but there are lots of little Silicon Valleys around the country in places you wouldn't think, in the middle of Texas, in the middle of Kentucky, in Ohio, because they meet a lot of the other criteria, transportation hubs and roads and a large population in the area and medical services. So they can attract workers because lifestyle is good. Cost of living is relatively low compared to Silicon Valley or San Francisco, where it's really expensive. So it allows Amazon to perhaps pay slightly lower wages than they would in some more traditional places and yet still get a really good workforce.
I have a feeling that this is going to be the new way companies decide where to put businesses, a big fanfare like this.
And by the way, it's been done for a long time with companies from overseas or out of the country or out of state where they try and negotiate these things. It is interesting to see that it's Amazon doing this. But one caution is places like Foxconn, which keep promising to build factories in America, and they don't get built.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Of course, we're following the advance of Hurricane Irma, but we want to spend a few minutes on the DACA program, the Trump administration's plan to rescind DACA, the Deferred Action Childhood Arrivals program that deferred deportation for young people brought to the U.S. illegally by parents before 2007, has many of them now worried that they will lose their jobs, the ability to attend school, Social Security numbers, and if DACA ends, they could face deportation. One of those people is Evelyn Salgado, a teacher at Cambridge High School in Nashville. Many of her students are also recipients of DACA benefits. Julieta Martinelli of WPLN spoke with her.
Evelyn Salgado was able to apply for DACA her senior year of high school. And after graduating from college in Kentucky, the 23-year-old is now back in Nashville, working in the same school district where she grew up.
I'm able to understand the struggles of a lot of my students.
Salgado has spent 2 years teaching Spanish to native speakers like herself, but only in the last few weeks has she been public about her immigration status. She says the bond with her students has deepened. Some have approached her after class and told her they look up to her, saying that she gives them hope.
They need to see someone who is strong, and they need to see someone who is willing to fight for them when maybe they don't have the voice that I'm able to have.
She shares some of their emotions, but she also remembers a time without DACA, growing up in the shadows.
You don't know what it's like to live in fear of being deported and sent to a country where you don't know. I'm not afraid of fighting. I will keep fighting.
Salgado turns away and covers her face for a moment, apologizing.
I haven't really taken the time to cry.
It's not just her classroom that Salgado's shouldering. In many ways, she is the pillar holding up her entire family. She is the sole college graduate, the only one with a driver's license, who can work a legal job.
I'm afraid of being deported. I cannot imagine my life elsewhere. President Trump ending DACA is like throwing us into a deportation pipeline, putting an expiration date in our future.
Salgado weighs this potential future against her desire to speak out, but she's willing to take a chance, even if it means risking a job that she loves. Though Metro Schools has publicly expressed support for DACA students, the district has so far remained mum on what will happen to its staff. For Here and Now, I'm Julieta Martinelli in Nashville.
So again, a look at one aspect of DACA, which again allows children brought illegally to this country to work, to join the military, as long as they don't have criminal records. Some have compared the economic output of these young DACA recipients to the H-2B visa program, which allows foreign workers into the country temporarily for seasonal jobs. Now, they do the hard and sometimes grueling work that employers say Americans don't want to do. And for some businesses, these temporary workers have become a lifeline. For instance, the seafood processing industry on the shores of Maryland, hundreds of Mexican women migrate to the U.S. every summer to pick meat from crab shells. Armando Truhl of WAMU reports on this.
Hooper's Island is a chain of three small landmasses on Maryland's eastern shore. About 500 people live in a handful of tiny fishing villages dating back to the 1600s. But this time of year, Hooper's Island has a nickname among the Latino immigrant communities of Chesapeake Bay. La Isla de las Mexicanas, the Island of Mexican Women. Every summer, several hundred Mexican women arrive on Hooper's Island to work at a handful of mom-and-pop seafood processors. They're called pickers. They use small, slim knives to pick the meat from freshly caught crabs. Elpidia Martinez started working here at Russell Hall Seafood 21 years ago. She was recruited in Hidalgo, Mexico, through a visa program called H-2B. My husband had died and I had four small daughters, she says, and laughs about how inexperienced and scared she was on her first day. Oh, I didn't even know what a crab was. Now she's a master picker. Her hands blur as she tears off claws and shells and picks the juicy white meat and sorts it into small plastic tubs. 2 decades of cuts from stubborn claws and slippery knives and an average salary of $10 an hour have paid for her daughter's education, a small home, and startup cash for her own business. There are pickers here as young as 18. As many as 600 Mexican women work in similar plants on Maryland's eastern shore. But it wasn't always like that, says Harry Phillips. He owns Russell Hall Seafood.
At one time, every lady on this island picked crabs. And back in the day, she actually brought her daughter with her, and her daughter would crack the claws.
Phillips says in the 60s, it became illegal to bring children under 16 into factories.
Well, by the time these girls were 16, they had other things on their mind, not picking crabs. And this made her mamas have to stay home with a lot of them because there weren't no babysitters back then. So that was the beginning of the end of the crab picker, the American crab picker.
So crab processors turned to Mexico and the H-2B visa program. The program started in 1987 with just 66 visas. Now it's 66,000. At the pier, Justin Aaron takes a break from unloading his catch. He says the end of the American picker almost spelled the end of many other small businesses, including watermen like him.
I'm done because ain't nobody's going to be down here for the box my fish up. I mean, it's tough anymore. It seems like the Americans don't really want to, ain't got the drive, the workforce.
This is the steaming room at G.W. Hall & Sons, another small seafood processor.
Tighten her up, turn the boiler on, and when she reaches 240 degrees, we set the timer for 7 minutes.
Owner Brian Hall is burly and in his mid-50s. Like many watermen, extremely well-tanned. His grandfather started the place.
When I was 3 or 4 years old, my father made me go count baskets on the trucks. That's how long I've been messing with this stuff.
Wow. Hall says a University of Maryland study found that H-2B pickers keep lots of Marylanders employed. Watermen, distributors, food package makers.
If we don't get them, that's 2.5 American jobs. For every one of them we don't get, it's going to be lost. And I don't think this country can afford to lose any more jobs. It's bad enough as it is.
Toddville is another village on Hooper's Island. But here, employers decided not to hire H-2B workers. And with not enough labor, processing plants had to shut down. Now, abandoned homes, damaged boats on rusty trailers, and hollowed-out warehouses dot the village. Bill Saling is the executive director of the Chesapeake Bay Seafood Industries Association. He takes me inside one of those warehouses. Broken fishing gear everywhere. Dust motes sail on light shafts from broken windows.
Very depressing. I mean, this was such a vibrant business, an enterprise, that this was a focal point for all the other industries in this area. Everybody would come here to buy and sell.
All gone. One sad reminder, a bulletin board hanging crookedly from the wall. The yellowed sheets date back to 2001.
And it'll never come back. I mean, nobody's ever going to buy this place and reopen it as a seafood plant.
I return to the Russell Hall plant to ask owner Harry Phillips one final question. I notice that on top of his building, Two flags were fluttering in the bright blue sky, the Stars and Stripes and the Mexican Eagle on a red, white, and green background.
We like Mexico. The ladies here, it makes them feel good. They like to see that flag. When they get here, that flag goes up. Yep. It's very important to us. Without these ladies, we wouldn't be in business.
The Mexican flag will go down sometime after September 30th, once there are no more crabs to be picked. Elpidia Martinez and her co-workers will return to Hidalgo, Mexico. And La Isla de las Mexicanas will once again be just Hooper's Island. Until next year, when the women will be back, as long as there's still an H-2B visa program. For Here and Now, I'm Armando Truhl, reporting from Hooper's Island, Maryland.
As Hurricane Irma makes its way to Florida, let's check in on the Caribbean, where it's already caused major damage. Irma battered the Turks and Caicos Islands early today with heavy winds and 20-foot waves. Earlier this week, the storm destroyed most of Barbuda and wreaked havoc on St. Martin and St. Bart's, where power and communications are still down. In St. Martin, the airport was badly damaged. Hugh Riley is Secretary General of the Caribbean Tourism Organization. That's the development agency that represents all 28 Caribbean countries. He's in Antigua. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeremy. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we heard yesterday that Antigua was spared, at least compared to Barbuda. What are you seeing there in Antigua?
Antigua really was spared. Barbuda, of course, is a different story. We are part of a rapid response team, and some deployment to Barbuda will occur later today, so that we'll get an opportunity as a member of the team to see what Barbuda looks like. But Antigua certainly has no sign at all of damage that's immediately obvious.
Now, your organization represents all of the Caribbean countries. Where is the damage the worst, as far as you know?
Reports are still coming in, and our team back in headquarters in Barbados is constantly updating. But it looked like close to 90% of the structures on Barbuda were damaged. We know that there's considerable damage in St. Martin. Reports are still coming in from Anguilla, but Anguilla, I believe, took it on the chin as well. The BVI, the British Virgin Islands, sustained damage as well. So did the U.S. Virgin Islands. Reports are still coming in on Puerto Rico, and we're not sure what's happening yet in the Bahamas as Irma moves further north. Turks and Caicos Islands, we are still trying to get some accurate assessment of what's happening in Turks and Caicos Islands as well.
But it sounds like you really don't know at this point what the extent of the damage is, in part because the communication lines aren't working.
That is correct. Some communication lines are up again via military or paramilitary sources, so that some of the islands that were initially hit pretty hard are not now entirely cut off. So there have been improvised arrangements to make sure that there is some communication, and we're able to take advantage of that. But yes, direct, normal cell phone communication is still extremely difficult in many places.
Now, you're just dealing with the immediate aftermath of this storm at this point, but what are you thinking about the long-term economic impact on these Caribbean islands if they've been, you know, largely destroyed, like Barbuda? That economy that is based on tourism is not going to happen, at least this year, right?
Well, of course, there are about 2.5 million of our people in the Caribbean that are employed in tourism. We have families that are completely dependent upon tourism, and we pay a lot of attention to our livelihood, as certainly we must. But to your point, we're not really able to give a proper assessment of what the requirements will be for rebuilding and reorganizing until we get a sense of exactly what the damage has been. The good news is that in countries such as Antigua and Barbuda, Barbuda, sadly, was hit pretty hard, but Antigua was not. Antigua is open for business. Bahamas, we talked about a little while ago, Bahamas itself covers a swath of territory that's over 100,000 square miles, so it's quite possible that something that happens in one part of the Bahamas, in the south, doesn't affect Nassau in any way. So we have to look at those, and of course, thankfully, there are countries in the Caribbean region that were untouched entirely by Irma. So you're right that as a whole, we have to look at what the economic impact is as well on the entire Caribbean. But the reality is that we rebuild very quickly from these kinds of incidents because we are not unaccustomed to incidents that require us to get our act together, dust ourselves off, and just get back to business fairly quickly. We're not unaccustomed to that.
How long do you think it's going to take to return to normal in the Caribbean?
It's hard to say, and that's going to be an island-by-island, country-by-country kind of decision. And some of these countries are French, and some are Dutch, and some are Spanish, and some are parts of the United States, and some are parts of the UK. All of those countries have stepped up very quickly and deployed assistance of one kind or another. So we're not on our own.
You're in Antigua now. Where's your next stop?
We are trying to get to Anguilla, where we need to take a close, first-hand look. Anguilla has taken a bit of a beating. We know that for sure. And we're trying to get to the British Virgin Islands. Air transportation is an issue because when you've got an airport that's closed or a runway that is damaged or even in uncertain condition. In this particular case where I am now, there is going to be some water transportation that's going to take some of us from Antigua to Barbuda. But of course, as you might imagine, in the current weather conditions, the seas are fairly choppy. But yes, we are going to do whatever we need to do to understand, to assess, to report accurately, and of course, to start the rebuilding process.
That's Hugh Riley, who is Secretary General of the Caribbean Tourism Organization, joining us today from Antigua. Secretary Riley, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. I greatly appreciate your time.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. Good luck, Florida. This is Here Now.